thank you, David. David and his wife Elizabeth have been very important to me over the years, and Elizabeth was one of the best students in that first class that I ever taught at the law school, and so it's been good to know them. I doubt that I've spoken here more often than Fritz has, but one thing I'm pretty sure of is that if Fritz hadn't come before, I wouldn't get the opportunity to speak on campus quite as much, because I think he paved the way for people to be open about their faith in ways that might be difficult otherwise. The title that was sent around was based upon a conference that I got invited to down at Emory in March, and it was called, the title of the conference is What Can Christian Theology Offer to the World of Law? And that conference at the Emory Center for Law and Religion was a good one, and it was informative. And then I got a chance with a group of some of the people who were there and some European scholars to go to a follow-up conference in Berlin last month. I have to say that the Berlin conference was actually better than the Atlanta conference in terms of at least the setting. The surroundings were really nice. But the particular title that I chose to address the topic of what can Christian theology offer to the world of law is God the Judge and Human Justice. My paper for the conference followed up on a point made by one of the other professors who I was paired with, a fellow named Jen Schroeder from Humboldt University, friend of Warren from Wayne from our religion department here. But he talked about how the biblical authors portray God as a judge. Often that's in terms of a final judgment, you know, after death, that God kind of evaluates all human conduct and issues rewards and punishments. But it also is displayed often in the biblical text in terms of God's providential control of human affairs. You often see God evaluating human conduct and fashioning either punishments or rewards that are designed to bring about justice. And so that portrayal of God as a judge invites reflection on what is the relationship between divine justice and human justice. And so my paper for this conference in Berlin focused on the biblical depictions of divine justice and whether they offer any insights for human law. There is a handout, I think, on your tables, because I'm going to be talking about some passages of scripture, and my slides are just going to give you some summary points, so if anybody wants to look at the passage in context, hopefully it's there in front of you. But I want to start with Jesus' story of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke's gospel. The narrative concerns a rich man who feasts daily. He routinely walks past this poor beggar named Lazarus, but he never stops to help. Jesus artistically describes how the rich man and Lazarus effectively trade places in the afterlife. In his earthly life, the rich man lives in luxury. In the afterlife, it's Lazarus who, it says, rests in the bosom of Abraham. Lazarus was hungry and covered with sores in this life, but in the afterlife, the rich man is thirsty and he's tormented by flame. Lazarus longed for a very small thing. He wanted some crumbs from the rich man's table. In the afterlife, the rich man longs for a very small thing. He wants some drops of water from Lazarus's finger. Lazarus begged. The rich man never stopped to help. And so in the afterlife, the rich man is begging, and Lazarus can't help him. In this life, the rich man presumably was well known. Lazarus was a nameless beggar. In the afterlife, Lazarus has a name, and it's the rich man who remains anonymous. Jesus' story, I think, is designed to give us a picture of perfect retributive justice. The sufferings of Lazarus in this life are matched by the rich man's sufferings after death. The rich man's indifference in this life is matched by Lazarus' incapacitation. I think the whole story is an extended illustration of one of the Proverbs. Proverbs 21:13 says, "Whoever closes his ear to the cry of the poor will himself call out and not be answered." And I think Jesus kind of displays that through the story of the rich man and Lazarus. Now, if you've heard me talk before, this is one I might have used previously. This is one of my favorite examples of biblical justice. But this is from the book of Genesis. In Genesis 27, there is this famous story of Jacob stealing the blessing that his father Isaac wanted to bestow on Jacob's brother Esau. The events are all orchestrated by Jacob's mother, Rebekah. Esau is out hunting, and so Jacob brings savory food to his father. He dresses like Esau, and he takes advantage of the fact that his father is blind, can't tell which son is there in front of him. The deception allows Jacob to substitute the younger son for the older son. And as a result, Isaac is deprived of his ability to choose who will get his spiritual blessing. A couple of chapters later, you see Jacob actually being deceived in a way that kind of corresponds to his deception of Isaac. And so this time, the events are orchestrated by Rebekah's brother, Laban. Jacob has worked 7 years for the right to marry Laban's younger daughter, Rachel. When the time has passed, Laban prepares a wedding feast, kind of reminding us of the savory food that Jacob brought to Isaac. And then he substitutes the older daughter, Leah, for the younger daughter, Rachel. Leah presumably isn't recognizable because she's dressed in the wedding veil like Rachel was supposed to be. And so Jacob, it's nighttime, he can't see. He's like Isaac now, that he can be deceived. And because of the deception, just as Isaac lost his ability to choose who would inherit his blessing, now Jacob loses his ability to choose who will be his wife. I think the author of Genesis wants us to see divine justice at work, providentially treating Jacob the same way he treated his father Isaac. Third example from 2 Chronicles chapter 26 has to do with King Uzziah. The author of Chronicles tells us about the king and an incident where he enters the temple wanting to burn incense there, even though the law of Moses reserved the priestly functions for those from the tribe of Levi who were descended from Aaron. If you think about it, Mosaic law, or at least Old Testament law, essentially created a form of separation of powers. The powers of the king were vested in the tribe of Judah. The powers of the priests were vested in the tribe of Levi. And so there was kind of this separation of temple and state that was kind of implemented through Old Testament law. But Uzziah is trying to cross that boundary. He wants to consolidate kingly power and religious power in his own hands. The punishment of Uzziah is described. Basically, he has leprosy break out on his forehead, and of course, at that point, he has to be isolated, and various consequences flow from that. The punishment of Uzziah, I think, isn't really explained, but we can see it as retributive in character if we think through what's going on. The first example I owe to my wife, Beth, who pointed this out to me, but basically it makes a point of the fact that Uzziah is in God's house, and he doesn't let God control what goes on in God's house, and so one of the consequences is Uzziah can't even control what goes on in his house. Now his son is running the household. Uzziah tries to seize religious authority that God had not given to him, and so the consequence is he loses the kingly authority that God did give to him. And then one of the interesting details is that God strikes Uzziah with leprosy on his forehead. I think this is an allusion to the part of the law of Moses that described the vestments worn by the high priest in the temple. The high priest was supposed to have a gold plate on his forehead that would say, "Holy to the Lord." And so God strikes Uzziah with leprosy, a sign of uncleanness, in that same place where the high priest would have had the sign proclaiming his holiness. I think God's judgments are not just retributive. Sometimes they're expressive, right? Sometimes he is expressing an opinion about the moral universe as he sees it. Fourth example I wanted to use is from the New Testament. This one is biblical justice focusing on divine rewards rather than punishment. You know, justice is not just about punishing those who do wrong, it's also about rewarding those who do right. And I think that Matthew's gospel shows us an example of divine rewards when you compare Matthew 4, the account of the temptation of Jesus by the devil, and then the end of the gospel where you see what we call the Great Commission. In Matthew 4, the third temptation, the devil takes Jesus to a high mountain and shows him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory, and he offers to give all of those kingdoms to Jesus if Jesus will just bow down and worship Satan. Jesus refuses the temptation, and he quotes the injunction from Deuteronomy that worship has to be reserved for God alone. I think Matthew wants us to hear an echo of that passage at the end of his gospel. Once again, Jesus is on a mountain. I have a friend who wrote a paper about the Gospel of Matthew suggesting that that's a structurally significant detail. There are seven places in Matthew where Jesus goes up on a mountain, and he suggests that those kind of have a structural significance in the text. So here's the first and the last times in Matthew's Gospel where Jesus is on a mountain. And now, notice that the disciples are worshiping him. Right? So the implication in light of Deuteronomy is they're recognizing him as God, so worship is now appropriate. And what Jesus tells them has happened echoes some of the language that the devil used in the third temptation. He says that all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to him. So I think the point is Jesus resisted the temptations to take the easy way out, to get to the kingship by an easy route. And so as a result, he gets an authority that is like what the devil offered him, only greater, a more extensive authority than Satan was offering. So I've been looking at passages in which God acts to secure retributive justice through sophisticated or artistic applications of something like the Old Testament talionic eye for an eye principle. For some people, that may raise a theological question based in part on the Sermon on the Mount. And there's this famous passage from the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus reflects on that talionic principle. He says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil, but if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. So some Christians read this as Jesus repudiating the lex talionis. The talionic principle is no longer valid. If that's really what Jesus is doing, then it kind of casts a theological cloud over this question of retributive justice. My short answer, I think, is that the Sermon on the Mount, if you back up as a whole, it repeatedly assumes that God enforces the demands of retributive justice. I've quoted a few passages from elsewhere in the sermon, but, you know, for instance, Jesus says, if you forgive others their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. If you do not forgive others their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. He says, judge not that you be not judged. He says, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. All of these are passages that teach that God treats people the way they treat others. In other words, that he is committed to a norm of retributive justice. So that suggests that we need to think more carefully about what Jesus is saying when he talks about the talionic eye for an eye principle. If we look closely at the things Jesus says in that passage from the Sermon on the Mount, I think each of his suggested courses of action is based upon the talionic principle, right? And so let's go back to it real quick. You know, he says, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also, right? Well, if the talionic principle applies, if somebody slaps you on the right cheek, what's the talionic response? You slap them on their cheek. But Jesus is saying, no, actually, you turn to him the other cheek. Let him slap you again. Right? And if somebody evil sues you for your cloak or your tunic, well, then you should sue them and get one of their garments, right? That's the talionic response. But Jesus says, no, give him your cloak as well. Give him another garment. And if somebody forces you to go a mile, then the eye for an eye principle would say, okay, you force them to go a mile. But Jesus says, no, go with them too, right? And so what I think is going on here is Jesus is urging a form of non-retaliation where the victim actually accepts the punishment that has been earned by the aggressor. Right? Now, I think there are limits to that principle in Matthew's gospel itself, right? So there's one place where Jesus says, when they persecute you in one place, flee to another. I'm not suggesting that every time you're a victim of any form of persecution, you automatically just kind of take it and more, right? But it's interesting that at least in these situations, a slap, somebody takes your garment, somebody makes you go somewhere you don't want to go, Jesus says, you take their punishment. And interestingly, I think Matthew wants us to see Jesus not only teaching that, but living it out himself later in the gospel. In the descriptions of Jesus' trial and his crucifixion, you see those same situations arising. You know, Jesus is slapped on his cheek during his trial before the high priest. We see him giving up his garments to the Roman soldiers. We see him going with an armed escort from Gethsemane to Caiaphas, from Caiaphas to Pilate, from Pilate to Golgotha. And so Jesus doesn't retaliate, right? Overall, I think the Sermon on the Mount is suggesting that there is this norm of retributive justice. But he's asking his followers to draw different implications from it than they were used to drawing. The talionic principle gives retributive justice a backward-looking focus. It says, look at how somebody has treated you. You treat them the same way. But Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, gives us the golden rule. Whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. See, he's reversed retributive justice. It's now forward-looking. It's not looking at how you have been treated. It's looking now at how would you like to be treated? What kind of relationship do you want to build with this person? And that is what governs your action. But I think all under the umbrella of this expectation of divine retributive justice that God treats people the way they treat others. Right? To this point, we've been thinking about biblical depictions of divine justice. This is a point I may have made before, so if it's familiar, I apologize for that. If I said it before, David didn't correct me, and so you can hold him responsible. But basically, I'm arguing that there is an analogy here to something you see in economics. Professional economists sometimes envision a perfectly competitive market, one where all of the goods are interchangeable, where there aren't any entry barriers, where all of the market participants have perfect information. And then that ideal of a perfectly functioning market serves as a basis for comparison to human markets. They can see inefficiencies, they can see market failures by comparison to this standard of perfect competition. And my thesis is that our biblical model of perfect justice lets us do something similar in the role of law, that we can use our biblical understanding of what perfect justice looks like to think about and critique human legal systems, to see where they fail, to see the limitations of human law. So I've got a few points along that score. The first point is that there are certain characteristics of God as judge that can serve as a model for human judges. This is logic that King Jehoshaphat makes explicit when he is instructing the judges of Judah. He tells them that they judge not for man, but for the Lord. And then he tells them, basically, imitate God as a judge. God is just, so the judges should be just. God is impartial, so they should also be impartial. God won't take a bribe, so neither should they take a bribe. But telling judges to imitate God will only take you so far, right? There's a problem, which is that God is very different from human judges in certain respects. He has much more knowledge, he has much more power than any human court can wield. Since he's more powerful than any human judge, that means that he can enforce laws that are more far-reaching than a human court can enforce. Human law always has to settle for enforcing a limited range of obligations. Christian theology has always understood that you have to distinguish between law, what the government is going to try to control, and morality, the way people ought to behave, that they can't be coextensive. Harvard law professor Bill Stuntz wrote an article a few years ago where he tried to describe this. He says, you're never going to find a law that says you must forgive your brother 70 times 7, right? Because no human court could ever enforce that law. We recognize that there are some moral obligations, things that God expects of us, that the government simply has to leave aside. It doesn't have the resources to enforce. So human law has to be less ambitious than divine law. Human judges also are considerably less accurate than the divine judge is. It's very common for a human court to review all of the evidence presented to it and to make a decision about what happened, and then you find out later on that they were just fundamentally wrong about really important facts. There's a case in my Trust and Estates class that we talk about where a man gave some money to his neighbor and told his neighbor what he wanted it to wanted done with the money after he died. And so the neighbor gets on the stand and swears, well, I was supposed to give the money to this sister, and this other sister wasn't supposed to get any of it. And so the court enters judgment based upon the neighbor's testimony. Later on, somebody actually finds a note in which the instructions are written out about what to do with the money, and it says, no, actually, both sisters are supposed to share the money. And the funny thing is, the neighbor actually signed that note, right? So either he got caught in making it up, or he just had the memory of a goldfish and didn't remember what the instructions were. But for whatever reason, the court's decision initially was based upon a view of the facts that were just completely wrong, right? Now, that's kind of a humorous example. Sometimes it gets tragic, right? Every year it seems like we find people who've spent, decades in jail, and new evidence suggests to us that they really didn't commit the crime that they have been punished for. Or an example from my Trust and Estates class from the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts. They had a case involving an 11-year-old girl who had been severely beaten by her stepfather. She was in a coma, and the courts had decided that they were going to withdraw life support because the doctors told them there's nothing you can do for her. She's just going to, she's in a permanent state. And so the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court says, yep, the doctors told us there's nothing we can do, so go ahead and withdraw life support. And the next day, the state child protective service agencies say, well, actually, she's doing better, right? And so here's a case where the long delay in the judicial process actually probably saved her life, but it got to the point where she was able to communicate with the people and has gone through rehabilitative therapy and is probably still severely damaged, but still living a life at this point, right? A third implication of divine justice for human law relates to our philosophy of punishment. If you read much of the theoretical literature about how courts should punish or how legislatures should punish, you find people dividing into two camps. There are the retributivists who say, well, the punishment should be based upon what a person deserves. And then there are the consequentialists who say, well, we should calculate the punishment that will produce the best social consequences. And they end up in these intractable debates about which is the better theory and why. Our examination of divine justice suggests that at one level, God seems to be in the retributivist camp. And in fact, the retributivists will often point to the eye for an eye principle and say, theology teaches retributivism. But I think this might be a good place to apply our lesson about the limits of human justice, right? Once we recognize that human law can't do anything like God's retributive justice, that it's a much more limited institution, then you recognize that you're in a rationing process, that you're having to make decisions about how the limited resources of the state legal system should be deployed. And when you're in that context, it seems to me it makes a lot of sense to take consequentialist considerations into account, to think about what will this use of government power do as opposed to an alternative use that we could make of it. Fourth implication for human law relates to proportionality review under the United States Constitution. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that under the Eighth Amendment, criminal punishments have to be proportional to the conduct that is being punished. Or under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment due process clause, that punitive damages awards have to be proportional to the underlying conduct. Problem is, you read these cases and they're never really convincing. And you often see the court dividing 5-4 or whatever. I mean, you know, there's one case they have to decide, is a life sentence without the possibility of parole disproportionate when the defendant commits his 7th nonviolent felony? Or when the defendant was found to be in possession of 650 grams of cocaine, was a life sentence disproportionate? Or is 25 years disproportionate when the defendant stole 3 expensive golf clubs, but it was after a string of prior offenses, right? And you read the court's reasoning and you say, well, yeah, I could agree with the majority, but I also agree with the dissent, and it's not clear who's right about this. I think our consideration of divine justice helps us to understand why those cases are unsatisfying. That in the biblical accounts, what you see is the divine justice is somehow like the offense. So it's easier to see if the punishment fits the crime. Human law homogenizes punishment, right? We punish everything either through a number of dollars or a number of days in jail. But the problem is there's no common scale that allows you to measure whether this act committed against another person is equal to this number of years in jail. Right? Finally, I think our study of divine justice can help us in offering a motive for mercy in human law. There are some legal theorists who come from the retributive perspective who consider mercy a problem. Because if you extend clemency to someone, then kind of by definition, you are departing from what justice requires, which in their view is that's the decisive consideration. St. Augustine actually faced a very similar question from a Roman judge named Macedonius. Basically, Macedonius wrote a letter to Augustine asking him, why is it that the priests keep interceding on behalf of these criminals who are appearing in front of his court? And he thinks that that's problematic, that it's almost like the church is condoning the criminal conduct that he's asked to address as a judge. And so Augustine gives a long and very interesting response, but one of the points that he makes is that the judge himself will have to face divine justice. He says, you need the mercy which you grant to others. See, I think Macedonius is thinking of himself as fundamentally different from the criminal defendants who appear before him. You know, I'm in one category, they're in a different category. And Augustine won't let him do that, points to divine justice to say, you know, actually, we're all on level ground. He says, we intercede, if not as criminals for criminals, at least as sinners for sinners, and I think with sinners. And so the fact that the judge is under the judgment of God gives him a reason to be merciful to the people who are before him. Now, one potential problem with Augustine's argument is, if I'm a judge, is there any logical stopping point to that, right? I want God to forgive me for everything I do wrong, right? And so does that mean that I should do the same with every defendant who appears before my court? That could get pretty unwieldy pretty quickly. And so I think there are some points that Augustine makes in the letter that maybe put some limits on his argument for clemency. He suggests that they're only interceding on behalf of people who have admitted that they've done wrong and are promising a change of behavior. He says that there are some people who would actually be harmed if you did not punish them, you know, that they would get into even worse problems down the road. And he suggests at one point that there's even a benefit from judicial severity. So he says, you know, there's good in your severity, which protects the public tranquility, but there is also good in our intercession, which restrains your severity. Right? So maybe the limiting principle is the judge should be inclined to show mercy, but not at the risk of undercutting the goals that the law is seeking to accomplish. So those are the points that I kind of laid out for discussion, but there are lots of other things we could talk about, and I wanted to leave some time for questions and answers. So let me know what you think. Yeah, so the idea of restorative justice is based upon Christian reflection on dispute resolution. That, you know, often in the biblical text you find a goal on emphasizing reconciliation. That when someone has committed an offense, what's really happened is there's been a breach of a relationship at one level. And so restorative justice is geared in part towards trying to bring restoration of that relationship. And I think there's a lot of value in doing that, particularly in certain contexts. I think, like juvenile justice, I think quite often the person is acting the way they are because they don't get it. They don't understand yet what they're doing to other people. And it seems to me in that context, that kind of restorative justice where you maybe have them sit down in a room with the family members and they have to face the victim and the victim explains, when you did that to me, here's how it felt and here are the consequences I suffered, that can be a teaching moment that can be really valuable. I think, think about the Jacob and Isaac example. Jacob deceives his father Isaac because he wants the blessing. But my guess is he probably didn't really think a whole lot about what that's going to mean for Isaac. What's it going to do to his father? But then later when Laban deceives him in the same way, he's kind of gone through a very similar deception. My guess is he had a lot more empathy for Isaac after that, right? And so maybe there's a sense in which even some of these stories of God's retributive justice are aimed at restoration of a relationship as one of the consequences. So I think it's a good idea. The big issue I talked about, rationing justice, which, there are some people who they would get very upset if I even mentioned that idea. But I think inevitably you're dealing with limited resources. You're having to pick what problems to address and how to address them. And a restorative justice system can be very administratively burdensome. And so I don't know if you could implement it as extensively as Prison Fellowship might like to see. Yeah. Yeah, and it gets back to that point about the limits of human judges, right? Some of the most difficult questions that we ask judges or juries to deal with is, why did the person do what they did, right? Were they intending to kill somebody? Was it an accident? Did they fire somebody because of their race, or was it because of job performance? Lots of contexts where we ask the person, the trier of fact, to figure out, why is the person doing what they're doing? And yet I suspect the error rate on those kinds of decisions is probably much higher than even the error rate on what was done, what happened.
I think you might have touched on this, but what I noticed when I listened to commentators, especially those who have very limited knowledge about Christianity, they usually tell us, oh, you have to forgive. Yeah. If I can forgive, I can only forgive to somebody who actually hurt me. So compassion is very important in personal relations, in the family. However, if somebody is murdered, I cannot forgive. in the macro level in society. Compassion belongs in your personal relations, because I don't want somebody who murdered somebody will let go out of jail, and the murdered family will be grieving for years and years and years, and this guy's eating a hamburger joint in Killer Burgers. Okay? So I think it's very, very important for us Christians to actually point out the fundamental fallacy of such thinking, where you apply compassion to murderers or to people who actually live beyond the limits of the law.
Yeah, and you raise, you know, probably the hardest example is somebody who is, you know, lost a family member to murder. And then the state seems to be making decisions about what's going to happen to the murderer, sometimes asking the family members what they want, sometimes not seeming to take that into account. I guess maybe the way that I would think about it is that there are, in many of these situations, there are multiple offenses. In other words, there is the offense done to the individual victim and to the victim's family, and then there's an offense against our society, our community. And so I guess I'm okay with the judges purporting to make decisions about what do you owe to the community, and should the community forgive the offense against our social order. I don't think that necessarily says that the victims have to forgive you, right? And one way to recognize that, for instance, is having separate criminal and civil punishments. That if you attack somebody, there might be a criminal punishment for your harm to the community, and then there might be a civil punishment for your harm to the family. And the fact that you got pardoned for the criminal offense wouldn't necessarily keep you from getting a civil judgment for the harm that you did to the individual victims. But I think that's those are hard questions. I remember Mike Huckabee, who is one of the Republican candidates for president, was governor of Arkansas, and he's a Baptist preacher. And he's somebody who is apt to look at the world through the lens of forgiveness, because the gospel is about forgiveness. And so, but there was one instance where he was governor, and he saw somebody who was in jail for, I think it was a murder, but it was under some circumstances where there might have been provocation or justification. And so eventually he decides to show mercy to this person, who then goes out and kills somebody else, right? There aren't necessarily easy answers, and again, it's based upon a human legal system that doesn't have the perfect knowledge that God has when He works out His justice. Yeah. Wayne.
A question of your interpretation of the voluntary doubling, the offense suffered. I've always seen that as sort of a voluntary doubling that makes the perpetrator, that reveals the nature of the perpetrator's action by voluntarily doubling. Is your interpretation where it's also sort of taking on a punishment, do you see those together, or do you see that as an alternative, or what?
Yeah, I think both of those could be possible. In other words, it could be that if you are accepting the punishment that the person deserves, that you also are showing them, you're teaching them something about their conduct and how to respond. And I guess the reason I tie it to this idea of taking on the punishment the person has earned is because I think Matthew does tie it into the conduct of Jesus later in the gospel. And so it's almost like he seems to be calling his followers to, in a small way, imitate or mirror what he does for sinners. But on the other hand, I don't think I can atone for somebody else's sin, and so I don't think it works the same way. I'd be happy to think some more about that one, and feel free to email me. I'd love to hear. Yeah, Josh.
Substitution, which also doesn't say first, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are ways in certain contexts in which the legal system permits substitution, right? That if I have acted in a way that incurs a penalty, you know, a monetary payment, it may be an insurance company comes in and pays it for me. There are actually limits on that in law. For instance, I cannot set up a trust fund that prospectively will pay any penalties or fines that the beneficiary might incur, because the courts say, well, you're encouraging them to engage in illegal activity at that point, and so the trust fund isn't enforceable. But that, you know, there are limits then to where the law will permit substitution. If I'm sentenced to jail, nobody can go for in my place, right? That's not permitted. So, again, maybe it's just a reflection on the complete divine justice compared to kind of this more limited institution that is designed to serve certain purposes in this world. And you can draw analogies, you can see pictures, but they're always going to break down at some level just because you're talking about very different judges.
Is there anything in your interactive
activities that you can learn from the knowledge of substitution? Yeah. Yeah, I know that's... I mean, I do think that you see kind of retributive justice and substitution layered on top of each other in Scripture. And so, for instance, in descriptions of Christ and his punishment, you see all these allusions back to the Garden of Eden. There's the crown of thorns, and there's the sweat, you know, dripping in the garden. And so I think we're supposed to see that as the new Adam somehow taking on the curse of the old Adam. And so there is, you know, substitution is Jesus stepping into Adam's place and accepting the retributive consequences of Adam's conduct. But I need to think some more about what, you know, what that might imply for human law, because I'm not sure how it carries over.
Hit our end, so wanted to thank you all for coming. Next month we'll be back on our Wednesday schedule.